supported KJAZ. 89.5 FM, KJZA Radio, Drake, Prescott, Williams, Cottonwood, Flagstaff, Arizona. Your national public radio and community programs connection. Coming up next, it's Dr. John Nay and the program Dinosaurs, Science, and the Bible. And be sure to listen at 9:30 this morning for Gerald Rogers and the program The Mountain Gardener from Waters Garden Center in Prescott.
Greetings and welcome to the 40th edition of Dinosaur Science in the Bible with Dr. John Nay. And this edition of Dinosaur Science in the Bible, we are going to be talking about natural selection. Dr. John, what's up for today?
Well, naturally, Dave, we're going to speak about natural selection today. Just exactly what is natural selection? And I have a definition here, just in case you've been wondering about this and just been lying awake at night, you know, and this thoughts occur to you. What is natural selection? Here's the definition from Webster's Ninth New Collegian Dictionary. A natural process that tends to cause the survival of individuals or groups best adjusted to the conditions under which they live, and that is equally important for the perpetuation of desirable genetic qualities and for the elimination of undesirable ones, as these are produced by genetic recombination or mutation. Wow. You know, just what exactly did that say? And basically a saying that natural selection and survival of the fittest are one and the same. And that is that the environment itself will select or weed out those that are not suited for survival in that particular environment. And, of course, conversely, those that are, they have what's necessary to survive under those particular climatic conditions, what's available as far as food, et cetera, they will survive. And this is the a pillar, if you will, of Darwin's theory of evolution, that nature, the environment itself, will weed out those that are not suitable for survival, and those that are will survive. And somehow, magically, this is a mechanism of evolving from one kind to another kind. And that's what I'd like to kind of take to task this morning on our program, if we might. And if you're just joining us, by the way, welcome to Dinosaur Science and the Bible. And I'm going to put this right up front now as I share this on this particular topic, Dave and I. If you have questions or comments relative to this topic, please contact me directly through email. The email is jnay@creationscience.net. I most certainly don't have all the answers. I most certainly do not believe that I have all the answers. But it's an interesting area. This area of evolution and the science in support of it relative to the creation viewpoint and the science in support of it. Not only is it interesting, but it has tremendous implications relative to its importance. So anyway, back to this. Now, we're going to start off with something really, really challenging this morning, Dave. And you really need to kind of focus, if you will, kind of zone in, because this is tough.
You have to wake up?
Yes, not only that, but yeah, that too. Okay. And it's going to be tougher than the two circles, one upon another one. Now, here we go. Okay, you ready?
I'm ready.
Deep breath, everything. Calm, heartbeats going down. That's good. Deep breathing from the diaphragm. Okay, now let's just say that we took 100 white rabbits. All right?
100
white rabbits. Very good, okay?
And
we took 100 brown rabbits, okay?
Brown rabbits.
So we have a total of how many rabbits?
200
now?
Rabbits.
Oh, I knew I was talking to the right guy. Okay, all right, now. And if we took these 200 rabbits, the 100 white rabbits and the 100...
Brown rabbits,
and we put them in the Arctic, okay? And we left them there for, let's say, 50 years. And we came back in 50 years... What color rabbits predominantly do you think we might be looking at?
White rabbits.
White, very good. I'm absolutely astounded. Okay. Yeah, white rabbits. Well, what might have happened to those brown rabbits?
They're easier seen and therefore easier prey.
Absolutely. Easier seen and therefore easier prey. And now, let's reverse this here a little bit. That was maybe a little too easy. Okay, now let's say we're going to take 100 white rabbits and 100 brown rabbits, and we're going to put them in South Africa. And we're going to come back in 50 years. And predominantly, what color rabbits might we find?
Brown.
Aha. And what might have happened to the white rabbits?
Easier prey.
Absolutely. You know, you worked at graduate work on an MDiv, too, didn't you?
Oh, yeah.
You have a degree from Pepperdine.
I'll
tell you what, that higher education really works.
Can't fool me, John.
Can't fool you. Couldn't get you on that one, okay? And now, let's take another example here. To understand this thing of natural selection, okay? Let's say you had a lizard, and he was in the process of evolving into a bird. I mean, he just decided he didn't like the lowlife, so to speak, okay? And he was going to move up in the world, so
to speak. Always aspired to fly.
That's it, absolutely, okay? And he was running from predators, fleeing along the ground as predators chased him, trying to eat him or to hurt him, if you will, and eventually his little footsies evolved into wings. And that, by the way, is what was proposed as far as where birds came from, lizards fleeing from predators. That's how it began, before all the technical garbage came in and that, and something called punctuated equilibrium.
Oh.
Well, the bottom line is, before this lizard had a good wing, or in this case, a good pair of wings, chances are his little feet would be really, really crummy little feet. Now, in this process of transitioning from lizard to bird, you know, when he really couldn't run very good because his little legs were just about becoming wings, but they weren't yet wings where he could fly, what might happen to this bird?
He'd get picked off easy.
He'd get picked off. I know I'm talking to the right person now. I'll tell you what. I may call you late at night sometime, Dave, when I'm pondering some deep question here.
No way that would survive.
That's right. Okay. He would be selected out. Now, that's basically what it's just about. And I have no problem with that at all. Now, I just thought came to mind. Now, this is scary, I know. This is a thought that came to mind. I had an article some years back that was given me, and basically it was had to do with the evolution of the elephant and how elephants in the southern part of the African continent were evolving so they would survive, survival of the fittest. And what was happening is the elephants in this particular region were being born with smaller and smaller tusks. And this had to do, again, with how they were evolving for their own preservation because of the pressure of hunters killing off the elephants with large tusks. And this was given as a proof of evolution, that they were evolving so they could survive in that environment under the circumstances of that environment, and in this case, under the pressure of the hunters. Well, the bottom line is, if you take and you go, you take a herd of elephants, and you're going to start shooting all the ones with the big tusks. And then let's say you're pretty successful in this region, and you kill off all the elephants with the big tusks, okay? Now, did the elephants evolve where they're only having smaller tusks now for their self-preservation? Or have you removed from the gene pool the genetic program for producing large tusks?
Bingo,
absolutely. All right, I just thought of three or four really bad jokes I'll take time for here. Okay, but anyway, so at any rate, you know, what you've done is you remove that genetic program from the gene pool of the elephants. Matter of fact, if you continued that, and you continue to shoot all of the bull elephants with tusks, eventually you're going to find a bull here and there where the bull and, I don't know what you call female elephant other than female elephant, the female elephant, was it? It was Dumbo, and what was the mother? I don't remember. Okay, there we go. First time you let me down, Dave. Okay. But you have a bull elephant, you have the female elephant, and they both have a damaged program relative to the production of tusks. Well, these two get married, then they're going to have, if they have a baby bull, that may have no program for the production of tusks. In other words, a tuskless bull, okay, because of genetic mutation. Well, if you kill off all of the tusked, the elephants with tusks, And the only thing left are those that have damaged genes for the production of tusks. Then you're going to remove that from the gene pool. It's something called gene depletion. In other words, the argumentation that the elephants are evolving smaller tusks for their own self-preservation is, well, it's just not true. It's not scientifically sound either when you look at the genetics of the thing. Okay, but we're given a different story for what we see, at least I believe, relative to what is in fact true. So anyway, natural selection, but is it a mechanism for demonstrating that one kind of an animal can become another kind? And that's where I beg to differ, that it most certainly is not. The difference, again, between the white rabbits and the brown rabbits in the Arctic and in South Africa, the difference between a white rabbit and a brown rabbit is one is a white rabbit and one is a
brown
rabbit. Yeah, okay, we're still rabbits. And, of course, you know what you call a row of rabbits walking backward, receding hairline. I just, oh, my. They go, I know, they're not worthy of mentioning. Okay, hair. So at any rate, but the difference between a brown rabbit and a white rabbit, one's brown, one's white, they're still rabbits. You know, don't get sidetracked. We need not be sidetracked by variety within a kind, okay? Variation within a kind, okay? There's not a mechanism of evolving from one kind to another kind. There's tremendous variety within the kind human being. But that doesn't mean that we're in the process of evolving into some other kind. That's just simply the variety within a particular kind. The Drosophila fruit fly, perhaps in school, those of you, you may recall the pictures in your biology book relative to the Drosophila fruit fly. Well, the poor Drosophila fruit flies have been tortured for years and years, where scientists have taken and exposed them to X-rays and to various chemicals, etc., to produce mutations. To see what would happen. And, you know, the Drosophila fruit fly used because of a very short gestation period. I guess people don't get too alarmed if you kill a fruit fly. Okay, you kill a mouse now, you could probably get in real trouble anymore, okay? And but with this experimentation with the Drosophila fruit flies, we ended up with a decrease in longevity. Not only that, but they didn't live as long, okay? You end up with Drosophila fruit flies that that were infertile, inferior. That is, they can't fly, they can't see, they have stunted wings, they have no wings, they have extra wings, have a foot coming out of the back of their head.
Just going the wrong way, John.
Absolutely, you know. And the bottom line is, you know, what might the Drosophila fruit flies with no wings, the Drosophila fruit fly with wings, the Drosophila fruit flies with an extra leg sticking out here or there, the Drosophila fruit flies that can't walk, what might they all have in common?
They're flies.
They're flies. They're Drosophila fruit flies. This is... You had a good night's rest, I can tell.
I'm ready for you.
Absolutely. No doubt in my mind. Okay. You know, here we are in this deep stuff here this morning, okay? But the bottom line is there's still Drosophila fruit flies. And you know, what is all this experimentation on these Drosophila fruit flies, what does it demonstrate? And the conclusion I came up with is that man can make life really, really miserable for Drosophila fruit flies. Yeah, and the bottom line is, you know, you can, mutations, I guess to begin with, are 99.999% harmful, not conducive to the survival of a particular kind or species. You know, these Drosophila fruit flies, you know, how are they going to do as far as with their infertile? How are they going to do if they have no wings and they can't fly? Well, how are they going to do if they have stunted wings and they fly around in a circle or upside down or whatever? It is not conducive to evolving to another kind, nor is it conducive to just surviving. Okay, it's a mechanism really for weeding things out.
You know, John, I've seen textbooks that say, you know, our theory of evolution is based on progressive mutations, beneficial mutations, and then they show you a picture of a harmful mutation. And why would that be, John? Why couldn't they show you a picture of a beneficial mutation in the textbook?
It might be because they don't have one.
There are none.
Oh, did I pass now?
Amazing.
Oh,
hey.
I had a good night's sleep, too. What can I say?
Oh, man.
Because iron sharpens iron. So one dull wit sharpens another dull wit. Here we are going this morning. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. And not a mechanism. Again, over and over again, this thing of variety within a kind is put forth as a mechanism of going from one kind to another kind. Variety within a kind just simply shows variety within a kind. So as a creationist, I have no problem with natural selection and survival of the fittest. I believe that is true. But it is most certainly not a mechanism of evolving from one kind to another kind. As a matter of fact, it really argues the creation side. Things reproduce according to their kind. Mm-hmm. Mutations are not good. They're 99.999% harmful to the survival of a particular species. The peppered moth of England. This is one that we've seen for years in our textbooks. And the peppered moth, the light-colored moth, after the Industrial Revolution got going, they supposedly evolved, if you will, for their own survival and became dark, you know, so that they could hide better from predatory birds that would feed upon them. And when that was reversed somewhat, they began to clean things up after the Industrial Revolution. Environmentalists stepped forward and objected to all that. Okay, you saw a resurgence of the lighter colored moths. Well, you know, again, a heavy question. Well, what's the difference between a dark peppered moth and a light-colored pepper moth? One's dark and one's light. You know, they're still peppered moths. It really doesn't demonstrate anything. It simply demonstrates that the survival of whatever the environment does have a major role in it. You know, natural selection does work. Nature will select those inferior, in a particular case of the Industrial Revolution, selecting out the lighter colored moths. They're easier to see, predators to find them and to eat them, than the darker ones. And we're back to this this thing of the we'd already touched on, and that is the genetic mutations. And you mentioned camouflage with the brown rabbit or the white rabbit. The picture I had a couple weeks ago here of the two deer out in the cornfield in Nebraska, they were well camouflaged, but there was a mutation genetically of one of the third deer, which was just snow white with pink eyes and pinkish ears. And because of damaged genes on the part of the buck and the doe, this offspring had no genetic code or program for producing melanin. And so completely absent, you have an albino deer, which is not going to survive very well in the environment. So nature will select it out. It's like I had an article out of Field & Stream magazine for a while that had a goldfish-colored largemouth bass, and there was a picture taken underwater, and here's this largemouth bass backed up kind of in the algae in that, green algae, but he's the color of a goldfish. And in the article I talked about, this happens every one out of so many 100,000 times, et cetera, and we don't find more of them because they get eaten. Absolutely.
Natural selection gets them.
Okay. And by the way, on that, what's the difference between a largemouth bass that's orange and a largemouth bass that's a greenback or green? You know, one is orange, one's green. They're still both bass.
Right.
Okay. So, variety within a kind is most certainly not evolution. And nature will select out those that are inferior for survival in that particular environment. Survival of the fittest does not explain their arrival. Okay? And this is where Darwin did not do. Darwin did not go back to the beginning. You know, how did all this begin? How did life begin? His emphasis was on variety within a kind and how over time the variety enables this particular kind to become another kind. That's what he was after. But it doesn't, it's not a mechanism for evolving to a higher level or into another kind, and it most certainly doesn't address the question of how all this began in the first place. Survival of the fittest does not explain arrival of the fittest.
John, isn't this whole survival of the fittest natural selection business about keeping the genetic code in a species pure? It's a conservative kind of biological thing that we see in nature. It conserves. It doesn't allow biological species to evolve into something else because it keeps it in line with its own species.
Yeah, and that is perhaps, you've hit a real important one there, Dave, that is perhaps part of God's design. Of course, God knew that eventually that man would sin. He knew that there would be the repercussions of sin, and of course, one of the big ones is death. Okay, not only for human beings, but for all organics, it would be death. And it is a way of keeping the gene pool healthy. You know, you have a damaged gene. Let's go back to that deer for a little bit. You have damaged gene for the production of melanin, so you end up with an albino deer. Well, that albino deer will most likely be weeded out through either, you know, a cougar, mountain lion, or a hunter, whatever, and be taken out of the gene pool, the one with the damaged genes, whereby if that white deer remained in the gene pool, and he was a buck, and he found just happened to find himself a doe that was albino, okay, and they began to breed, you end up with, you would be corrupting the gene pool, in a sense. But the environment weeds out those that are inferior, thus natural selection or survival of the fittest, which is a good thing, as you mentioned, keeping the gene pool healthy. So that perhaps that was part of God's initial design, of course. Mm. And God knew, there's no surprise to God, of course, that man would choose to sin and have the implications that go along with that. So anyway, variety within a kind, selective breeding upon the part of the kind or man's intervention, none of these things have to do with evolving from one kind into another kind. And another thing I want to mention briefly, which I mentioned in other sessions, and this thing about natural selection, is that, let's say a zebra selected a donkey, fell in love with a donkey, and they had with a baby zonkey. And of course, now we take and you breed a zonkey with a zonkey, you hit a genetic dead end. Or a lion falls in love with a tiger, and you end up with a baby ligers, okay? And then a liger falls in with a liger, you end up with a genetic dead end. Or a horse and a donkey and a mule, and a mule and a mule, a genetic dead end. Again, those dead ends might not have existed at one time, you know, because of circumstances in a particular environment, food supply, climatic conditions, selective breeding on the part of the animals. You end up with genetic barriers, again, that might not have existed at one time. And that takes us back to this thing about, you know, getting all the animals on the ark, if you will, or Adam naming all the animals within a literal day period of time. You know, we have a tremendous amount of variety now as a result of man's intervention, as a result of climate and diet, etc. And we also have genetic dead ends that might not have been there at one time. So I said all that to say, at one time, perhaps nowhere near the variety within a kind, a genera, as we have now. And also not having the genetic barriers that we have now between one kind and another kind. How are we doing?
Good.
We're doing. How are we doing in time, Dave?
About 7 minutes.
About 7 minutes, okay. Well, let's go just a little bit more here. A couple quotes I'd like to share, if I might. And the first quote comes from a co-holder of the 1945 Nobel Peace Prize for developing penicillin, Sir Ernest Chain. And he made this statement: to postulate, that is to propose, to postulate that the development and survival of the fittest is entirely a consequence of chance mutations seems to me a hypothesis based on no evidence and irreconcilable with the facts. These classical evolutionary theories are a gross oversimplification of an immensely complex and intricate mass of facts. And it amazes me that they are swallowed so uncritically and readily, and for such a long time by so many scientists, without a murmur of protest. Now, this is a man that is a co-holder of the Nobel Peace Prize for developing penicillin, 1945. This is a man with impeccable scientific credentials. The 1971 winner of the Nobel Peace Prize in Science, Dr. Dennis Gabor, stated this, quote, "I just cannot believe that everything developed by random mutations." And he used the right word there, believe. Dr. Etheridge, world-famous paleontologist of the British Museum, has remarked this, quote, "Nine-tenths of the talk of evolutionists is sheer nonsense, not founded on observation," which is, of course, what the scientific method is about, "and wholly unsupported by facts. This museum is full of proofs of the utter falsity of their views. In all this great museum, there is not a particle of evidence of the transmutation of species." alluded to him earlier. I couldn't remember his name. And that was the 70 or 7 million fossils that I think you referred to, Dave. Mm-hmm. Dr. Albert Fleshman of the University of Erlangen made this statement. He said, "I reject evolution because I deem it obsolete. Because the knowledge hard won since 1830 of anatomy, histology, cretology, and embryology cannot be made to accord with its basic idea. The foundationless, fantastic edifice of the evolution doctrine would long ago have met with its long-deserved fate were it not that the love of fairy tales is so deep-rooted in the hearts of man." And I want to kind of bring us toward a conclusion here this morning, Dave, with this quote. And that is natural selection. The quote is this again, as far as a definition. "A natural process that tends to cause the survival of individuals or groups best adjusted to the conditions under which they live. And that is equally important for the perpetuation of desirable genetic qualities and for the elimination of undesirable ones, as these are produced by genetic recombination or mutation." So the whole idea of natural selection, survival of the fittest, yes, that's a reality. And as far as being a mechanism for the evolution of one kind into another kind, most certainly not. Quite the opposite of that, as a matter of fact. As you mentioned, Dave, the process of natural selection, survival of the fittest, basically helps to keep a healthy gene pool. It weeds out those that are inferior. And those that are inferior, for them to be evolving into something more superior, there's a real problem with that, of course. And the problem is it doesn't work. That's just the bottom line.
That's right. And, you know, you would think that after all the experimentation has been done with fruit flies and other things, and not ever finding a beneficial mutation, they'd catch on after a while.
People believe what they choose to believe. That's just all there is to it.
Don't confuse me with the facts.
No, absolutely not. And I think, you know, for all of us, so regardless of what the side of the issue this morning you might fall on, I'm talking about the issue being evolution relative to the creation account of the Bible. Regardless of what side you might fall on, I would pray we would all be open to hear the argumentation for various views. That's the way we grow. And again, our scripture is iron sharpens iron, so one man another. It's good, healthy discussion to assess what you believe and why you believe it. And then to hear a person with a differing view and to assess why they believe what they believe. And if it's different than what you believe and why you believe what you believe and makes more sense, then we need to be pliable enough and humble enough to change our views. And that's true, again, for wherever a person falls relative to this topic.
Yeah, that's right, John. And, you know, I know from my own experience, it has been that the hardest thing for me to do when I'm talking to an evolutionist is to get them to listen to a creationist point of view, to get them to read a book or listen to a cassette tape or watch a DVD or video. They just don't have any time for that for some reason. They've got plenty of time for 100 other things, but when it comes to that, looking at the creationist point of view, they just can't find the time.
Yeah, I think, you know, for what has happened in our culture, at least it appears to me in the last dozen or so years, is when the evolution side is put forth, any comment relative to those that would have a differing view, intelligent design or the creation account of the Bible, that don't even waste your time. These are people that believe in a flat earth. They're completely out of tune touch with reality. There are no credible scientists that believe this. I mean, it's put forth now, don't waste your time, which is unfortunate because that person is not getting the opportunity or affording themselves the opportunity to hear the other story. And we're back to Proverbs 18:17. Any story sounds true until someone tells the other side and sets the record straight.
That's right. And you know, both the creationists and evolutionists have the same set of facts that are out there. It's just a different interpretation of those facts that we're coming up with here. It's almost time to go, John. How do people write you a question?
You can contact me through my email address, which is jnay@creationscience.net. jnay@creationscience.net. I really solicit your input, your comments, your questions, and I would like to thank Prescott Valley Christian Church for their support of this program, along with Palmer Christian Church also.
Okay, time to go. We'll see you next week.